Hanji, Sashikal, welcome back to the Paul Show. This was 1 week after my exam. I passed my slot to the certification and I'm officially into cyber slot now. So that was a career update for me. And today we have a very special episode where we're going to discuss about the topics that are not usually discussed in a bigger gatherings. People try to be shush about it, and so I thought it was the right opportunity for me to talk with a person who is quite vocal about his opinions. So today, the entire episode is about it. So before we go into that topic, we're going to discuss the person and his interests. So here we have Mr. Nabil Chaumun from Concordia University. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Anjeev. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so Mr. Nabil met me when I was having my ISO meeting online. So that's how we met. So why don't you tell us something about you, Nabil? What's your interest and what you are doing in Concordia?
Yeah, sure. Well, again, thank you so much for having me. So I'm currently in my last semester of athletic therapy. And for those of you who don't know, athletic therapy is kind of a mix between emergency response on field, and then there's the rehab portion. So it's a bit like a physical therapist in that sense. So it's really the best of both worlds in that aspect. And we usually work more with team sports teams, whether it be contact, non-contact, or in clinical settings, and really anywhere where sports is a main interest. I'm also doing my internship at Dawson College at the moment. So I'm working with the basketball team there as well in the clinic. And I also work at the Concordia's Welcome Crew as part of a Welcome Crew mentor, which is also under the umbrella of the Student Success Center. So basically my main interests are my program, athletic therapy, helping people out through the mentorship program that they have at Concordia, and also advocating and, you know, sharing a lot of what we are about to talk about in this podcast later.
For sure, for sure. Before we get into that, I want to know, how did you get into athletic therapy? Like, this is kind of course that normally not many people who are coming to Canada know about it. How did you get into athletic therapy?
Yeah, so it's kind of a funny story, actually. So my parents always wanted me to go into medicine, always wanted me to become a doctor. I was never against the idea per se, but it was more like the way I viewed doctors was more as a static job. You know what I mean? So it's more like you're a guy in the office, you're prescribing medicine, and that's kind of the extent of the doctor's role, as far as I know. So me and my dad were coming back from a university. Medical kind of event, and they were showing off like, okay, if you come to this university, then, you know, we have our medical program, and these are the things that we offer, so on and so forth. And I really wasn't that interested. And on the way back, I told my dad, like, well, you know what, Dad, like, I really don't like this. Like, this is not where I want to be. And he's like, well, okay, well, that's fine, but what do you want to do instead? And I really like sports at the time too. So I said, well, what about something to do with like sports and therapy and rehabilitation, stuff like that? And he's like, well, do you know program? And I said, no. But so I kind of just left it at that. But then we're actually originally from Montreal. Basically he told me, like, and we're living in Qatar at the time, and he said that, well, Concordia University has this athletic therapy program, and it intrigued me. So I looked into it. I was like, well, this sounds exactly what I want to do. So, like, in terms of rehab and also like that team kind of experience, I've always thrived in those team kind of environments. So I feel like that was the perfect fit for me. And so far so good. I feel like I've made the right career choice.
It so does. If it was up to me, if I had the knowledge of these courses, I would have personally opted for athletic therapy, because I am quite athletic, if I am being honest, and I love sports. So I think after your degree, do you have to do another courses to be much more, you know, active in this field, or you can just go straight to the teams and say I'm eligible to be a part of your team or athletic therapy?
Well, so basically after I'm done with the degree, there's still the certification exam that's given out by CATA, which is the Canadian Athletic Therapy Association. So there's that certification exam that I have to do, and obviously I have to pass it. And in terms of courses that I have to do afterwards, CATA mandates that every athletic therapist, to keep their certification, they have to do a certain amount of continuing education units, or CEUs. And basically that's just to make sure that therapists stay up to date with the latest developments in therapy. You know, if there are any changes, especially with on field as well. Like, if you're going to take someone off the field with an injury, you want to make sure you're doing it the safest way possible, for example. Or if let's say there's a spine, issues to do with the spine, especially, those are very sensitive. So what is the best possible way in addressing that? And you know, it's health field, so it's really never ending. So those are basically the courses that we have to do afterwards.
Sure. So if somebody, let's say, is coming from a different country and he wants to pursue this field, what specific courses do you think he should primarily focus on in his high school?
In high school, I would say focus a lot on biology. That really helps a lot. Well, if someone's coming in internationally, they have to do prerequisites anyway, for the most part. So, like, really make sure you're good with your physics, biology, chemistry, because those are the foundation courses that you have to take, like the prerequisite courses. a lot of high schools don't offer this, but if someone can get their hands on a good anatomy book, or if they can do their own self-studying to do with the human body, being able to identify different components of the human body, physiology as well, I feel like anatomy especially, that's what differentiates a good therapist versus an excellent therapist.
Okay.
So I would say focus on more anatomy and physiology.
Yeah. So here you have it, guys. So if you want to go into athletic therapy, you should definitely focus on anatomy. And I actually had a funny question before we go into the serious topic. So there are some massage guns that you see in the market, you know. So are those massage guns worth it? Worth the money, or they are just for, just there?
Are they worth the money? I personally, this is my personal opinion, I don't think so. If you're going to use it for your own use, then probably not, because I feel like with just a lacrosse ball, or if you can learn how to do the massage techniques yourself in a proper manner, I feel like that would be just as effective. Or yes, yeah, so, and there's different equipment too. So I just mentioned a lacrosse ball, there's different objects, there's something called the Graston technique, where you use kind of like a metal blade. Well, it's not a blade like you're shaving, but it's kind of like the handle of a spoon, where you kind of scrape and whatnot. So there are techniques around it. It can come in handy if you're working, like, let's say in a team setting where obviously the therapist doesn't want to massage 20 yeah. people like after a practice or something. So that can be very applicable. But I think for the individual, I think it's better if they just if they can learn how to do the massage techniques themselves. But also, if someone requires a massage every day, then that would mean that they have an underlying problem that they have to get resolved in the first place. So if that's what's happening, then I would recommend going to see an athletic therapist.
Yeah, for sure. So that sums up our first part of the introduction with Nabil Soman. And you stay tuned to CJLO 1690 AM, and you're tuned into the Paul Show. And now after the break, we're going to discuss some topics that are really sensitive and we should definitely raise our voice. So stay tuned. Yeah, so welcome back to the Paul Show. So we are with Nabil. And so now we're going to shift our focus to something that's really close to Nabil's heart and my heart as well, because we need to raise our voice. So tell me, Nabil, how did you get into this information? Like, how did you become so vocal about the topic, about the Uyghur movement and the China? So how did you get into it?
Yeah, so personally, it's something that's recurred quite a few times in my life, but I never really paid too much attention to up until last year, about April-ish. So the first time I heard about it, I was actually carpooling with someone who was from China. Mm-hmm. And it was about Ramadan. And for those of you who don't know, Ramadan is basically the month where Muslims fast for a whole month, full 30 days. And basically what he told me was, yeah, there's a group of people in China who the government mandates that they cannot fast. Like, it's a rule that if they're fasting, they get fined, they can be in trouble in work and whatnot. And at work, actually, they purposefully bring food just to prove that they're not fasting. Like, the bosses will bring food to the employees. And I thought, okay, well, that's bad, but well, whatever. It's not like someone's dying or whatever, right? But little did I know, right? And then later on, like, I kept hearing about this more and more, especially when I came to, when I came back to Montreal and Concordia. There was someone who, because I lived in dorms, so I had a neighbor actually, and we're having dinner once in the cafeteria, and he told me, we're talking about TV, and he told me, oh yeah, in Pakistan, he was from Pakistan. He said in Pakistan, they have hundreds, or like he gave me some absurd number. He said, we have hundreds of Chinese TV channels. And I said, why would there be hundreds of Chinese TV channels in Pakistan? Is there like a mass movement to learn Chinese there or something? And I found that very strange. And he said, no, it's because all of the migrant workers that come from China, because of all the infrastructure deals and stuff that they have, so, you know, for entertainment purposes and whatnot. And I said, oh, okay, well, still, that's kind of strange, but okay. And then throughout the months and throughout the years, I started hearing more and more about the Uyghur oppression, because 2017-18, that's when the internment camps started to prop up. So I started hearing about this, but I think the nail in the coffin for me was, I heard this from a podcast. It's called The Three Muslims, and they brought on the secretary of the Uyghur Revival Association, Arsalan Hidayat, and he gave a comprehensive review basically of what is happening in East Turkestan. And from that day onwards, I was like, I was amazed that no one was talking about this. So I took it upon myself to bring awareness to this.
So I remember when I got to know about this stuff, and like it was last year or maybe 2020, and it somehow makes you feel like we are not equal in this world. Like there are some places that are still not the places that way you should live, because they are quite living in a past where they do not consider everyone as equal. So I have also heard that this stuff is illegal. So can you just tell us something about it? Because I remember.
Yeah, so basically, the laws in East Turkestan do not apply to the rest of the other peoples of China. So you have the Han Chinese majority, and then you have the Uyghurs. And it's basically the Uyghurs are living as secondary citizens and have additional rules applied to them. And a lot of them have to do with the fact that they are Muslim, and they specifically target those aspects of their culture. And the thing about it is, well, like, for example, me, I'm a Canadian national, like I'm born and raised here. But for me, the government will never get involved with me if I say I don't like Tim Hortons, for example, right? They'll never say like, oh, you're not Canadian if you don't go to Tim Hortons every for breakfast, or if you don't drink Molson beer or whatever, right? But in China, or sorry, in East Turkestan, if a Uyghur does not comply with what the government defines as Chinese, then they can be put into those prison camps. And I actually have a list here of the different things that can get people into trouble in East Turkestan. So, and you know, bear with me, these are very ridiculous rules. So
before we go to the list, so East Turkestan, is that part of China or it's a different place, like a geographical question?
So that's a very good question, actually. So East Turkestan borders China. It is not a part of China. And the word Xinjiang actually does not actually goes contrary to the narrative that it's part of China. Xinjiang means new land or new frontier that was given to them by the Manchu Empire. So it doesn't fit that narrative. And actually Uyghur people are very annoyed when they get put into one big monolith and people just refer to them as China, because they're not Chinese ethnically, they're Turkic. So when you think of Turkey, you think of Turkey, Turkmenistan, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, all those countries like that. So it is not a part of China whatsoever. Yep.
Okay.
So so to go into just some of the rules that Uyghurs can get into trouble with, and this is according to SaveUyghur.org. You can look up the list later for anyone interested. So you can get in trouble for owning a tent, owning welding equipment, owning extra food, owning a compass, owning multiple knives, staying away from alcohol and cigarettes. If you're sad or if you wail, you publicly grieve for a lost one, for a parent or a family member, you can be put in prison. If you disallow officials from sleeping or eating from your food, like in your house, so basically these officials come into your house, and if they say, hey, I want to sleep with your wife, just to make sure you're not doing anything crazy or whatever, you have to allow it. Otherwise, you go to jail, your wife goes to jail. And I see you're astonished, and that's just like 10 of the rules here. And then later on, if you don't let an official scan your iris, if you don't let them download your phone contents, if you don't let them record your voice, if you also, and this is extremely sad, if you try to kill yourself while being detained by a police officer, you get put in jail. And if you try to kill yourself in jail as a way of escaping, they won't even let you do that. they will punish you even more. And the way this works is the goal isn't to kill necessarily. That's not what the Chinese government's goal is. It's to overwork and get as much juice the Uyghur people as much as possible for economic gain. And that's what's completely sickening about this.
One of the rules that you just told me was to you cannot stay away from alcohol and drugs. That's what you said.
Yep.
But in the Islam and in the Muslim religion, it's like you are forbidden to even be close to alcohol.
That's so right.
So they're technically trying to manipulate you to kind of convert?
The CCP actually does not recognize any religion. They're anti any religion, whether it's Islam, Christianity, Buddhism. Actually, a lot of the things that we're about to mention later on in terms of oppression has already happened to other religious groups as well. If you look up the Falun Gong, which is a new wave form of Buddhism, this has already happened before, and they're just going through the motions of just eliminating another race. This is just for them, for the CCP, this is just another box to tick off in their oppressive regime. So the reason why these rules are in place is it's because they view this as too Islamic, and Islam in their minds is terroristic. So, and they view this as a threat to their way of life. So in order to counteract that, they put these rules in place to make sure that, okay, to make sure that they're not abiding by Islam or by whatever religion they decide to follow, and that they're abiding by our rules and our regulations. There's also, in terms of religion too, this is actually well known, but not spoken about a lot. The CCP has actually come out with their own version of the Quran, which is the religious text. Yeah, so they have a CCP, a Chinese translation of the Quran. So it's in the context of what their interests are, and not what the actual Arabic says.
So the Chinese version of the Islam, the Quran, is that almost identical to what is being written in the right words, or it's they have just framed it in a different way so that they are trying to promote their own culture?
Exactly. So they framed it in a way so that it reflects their interests.
No. Okay. And also, it's so blatant to know that how stupid those rules are. And I think there are very few. Like, there must be hundreds of these kind of rules.
Yeah. And again, you can find all these rules on saveuyghur.org.
Okay. The place that they are in, it's called Xinjiang?
Yeah, so it's recognized as Xinjiang, yeah.
Xinjiang. So it's owned by the Chinese government or the East Turkestan?
So it's now been annexed. So the Manchu Empire actually annexed that part back in the 1800s. So technically, it's called the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, but it's only autonomous by name and not actually in reality.
So who is the right owner of that place? Like, who is the government there? Who owns that place? Who makes the rules?
So that would be the CCP still.
CCP, okay. So it's technically not East Turkestan now. It's like named to a different Xinjiang.
Exactly. So the reason I use the word East Turkestan is because Xinjiang is recognized to be a colonial term. So to not promote that, I'll be using the actual term that Uyghurs would prefer.
Got it. So how much population is there for Uyghurs?
So the Uyghur population is estimated to be between 12 and 13 million, but I believe it might be slightly, it's pretty accurate, but I believe it would be slightly more than just 13 million. But again, like the recent census, I don't think has been out. Like these are based on pretty old numbers, so we take it with a grain of salt.
So yeah, so there has been a worldwide movement to protect the Uyghurs from this kind of stuff that's happening by the Chinese government. But yeah, I have also heard about the concentration camps that are going on. So tell us what's happening there.
Yeah, so I mean, it's complete chaos, really, and it just doing research for this has been so overwhelming for me, especially. And you know, I hope the audience can, you know, sympathize with what's going on and really listen. So to start off, the concentration camps, the Chinese officials, the CCP, Chinese Communist Party, they initially denied the claims of even having these camps in the first place, and then later on, when it was revealed that these camps actually exist, they said, okay, well, it's not internment camps, it's not concentration camps, it's re-education camps. These people are coming in willingly, and it's only 10,000 people anyway, but that's completely false, actually. It's between 1 to 3 million people who are in these camps. So then again, the numbers don't match up clearly. And just to quote something from the World Uyghur Congress, this is witness testimony. So it says, conditions in the camps are reportedly very poor, with massive overcrowding and squalid living places. Those detained in the camps have regularly been subjected to acts of torture, including food deprivation, solitary confinement, the use of the tiger chair, which is a device that clamped down on the victim's wrists and ankles, and being hung by their wrists and against a barred wall. So a bit more about the tiger chair. It's something that they used to either interrogate or torture. And there's even sexual torture as well that goes on in these camps as well. So this is from CNN, and one of the an ex-guard actually said that an electric baton was tied to the detainees' genitals using electrical wires as a means of getting detainees to confess. And the police officers would also order prisoners to sexually assault detainees. So it's complete, it's something you can't even begin to imagine. It's a whole other level of torture. There's also forced sterilizations, abortions, and rape that happen. And this comes, the forced sterilization actually comes as a result of the one-child policy that happened in 1980, the two-child policy that happened for minorities, which eventually led to the Barren Massacre, which saw thousands of people die. The Chinese official numbers say only 7 people died, but obviously that's not true.
For sure.
And actually, babies are being aborted not in the first trimester. They're being aborted at 7, 8, 9 months, right before they're given birth to. And even if women end up giving birth, they're heavily fined or they're sent to jail or both in some cases. And
what's the reason behind it? Why are they doing it?
Well, this is actually part of genocide. This is one of the definitions. So they are trying to limit the amount of Uyghurs that come that are put into existence because they view them as the enemy, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's part of the reason. And also, this is something from C.J. Werleman, who's a journalist, and he says that the Uyghur population growth rate in East Turkestan has fallen up by upwards of 80% in the past few years. So again, I'm not too sure about the figures of the population. It might have gone down or up, I'm not sure, but the Uyghur population itself is going down. And I just want to read out, this came out last year in February, and this is a witness report from Tursine Ziyaudun, who is a survivor from the camp. And I mean, after the woman spoke about her conditions, this is as a response to while she was bleeding in the camp, as you know, after torture, someone else stood up for her, and she said that the woman spoke up for her, and the Chinese policemen swore at her, and they said, take her into a dark room. So they took her to that room, and she had been taken in, and they had an electric stick, and they would push it in their genital tracts just to torture them, to silence them. And it says here that the girl became completely different after that. She wouldn't speak to anyone. She sat quietly, started staring as if she was in a trance. And later on, she says there were many people in those cells who lost their minds. And she herself is someone who lost her uterus in that her uterus was taken out of her surgically. So, I mean, we can pause here and just listen to this and think to ourselves, how can an individual even think about doing this to millions of women, let alone one?
Yeah.
It's completely sickening. And also there's something called halal organ harvesting. This might be the last thing I'll mention. Halal organ harvesting. So the word halal, you've probably seen it, in Arabic prostitutes and stuff. So basically this is just it's used as a advertising tool. So when you get an organ donation, usually someone else dies and then you're told, hey, so-and-so passed away and you can use their organs, right? But in China, it's the complete opposite. What happens is you order your organ and it comes whenever you want. And basically what happens is these Uyghur detainees are being shot to the point, right? Not at the point of death necessarily, because if you die, then the organ dies too. They're being shot to the point where they go unconscious enough. And then the surgeons go in and they operate and extract those organs from them. And then they die through that. And this is work that you can find by CJ Werleman and Taiwan News as well.
What is the United Nations doing about it? The main question that's coming in my mind.
Well, we know what the United Nations work is supposed to be, but in reality, it goes it contradicts what their mission should be. So a recent whistleblower by the name of Emma Riley actually came out saying that the UN is actually, they have this practice of giving out names of Uyghur activists who are about to speak. And they give out these names to the Chinese government so that they know in advance and they can put pressure on these activists from speaking out, and they can put pressure on their families who are still in China and say, hey, if your family member speaks, then we're putting you in jail for that. Or we'll send out spies or whatever officials to go harm them. So make sure they don't speak on that. So that's how they suppress, actually. Actually, something that happened at Concordia University itself, Dolkun Issa, who is part of the World Uyghur Congress, I believe he's the president of the World Uyghur Congress. I could be wrong about that. My point is, he's a pretty high ranking activist. He was supposed to give a talk at Concordia University under MIGS, which is basically the Montreal Institute for Genocide that's established at Concordia. And right before he was set to give out the speech, Chinese officials put pressure on Kyle Matthews, who also works for MIGS. He ignored it at first, but then he started to realize that people in Concordia were receiving threats as well to shut down the event. And lo and behold, it did get shut down. So that's one reason as to why people don't understand or know about the situation, because whenever something does happen, it gets shut down pretty much immediately.
Which is one of the main reasons why it's very difficult to talk about this topic, as it's too sensitive and you don't know who is listening. That's the main question. Exactly. So we're going to take a break, and afterwards we're going to discuss how it's affecting Canada and how it's affecting the Winter Olympics that are going to go on in Beijing 2022. So stay tuned at CGL 1690 AM, and we'll be back.
Yapacağım. yaşardı bizim can. Dünyanı körgende cinim bana dost. Yaşardı bizim can.
So welcome back. So we were talking about a situation that's getting far worse every day if we don't speak about it. So which is one of the reasons why I thought it would be better if we talk on this platform. So how do you think this entire situation is affecting people living in Canada?
So it affects Canadians in a very big way, actually, but it's very implicit. So one, you can look at it through the lens of the genocide that we had here not too long ago, actually. And actually just a few hours ago, we were in a workshop with someone who was telling us about the First Nations experience and how it's affected his people. And what he said was residential schools are a very big topic now. About 7,000 children were found in these schools to have been buried there. The last residential school, believe it or not, closed in 1996. That's only 2 years before I was born. So that this is very recent history, and I believe that we should learn from this history as well. And again, we're still finding more and more evidence of this. So this isn't something, it's not like we look at the pictures and they're black and white and we think this is from the 1700s or whatever. Yeah. This is recent. This is right now at our doorstep. And the government is trying to make amends and, you know, give credit where credit is due, but we shouldn't be in this position anyway, where we think to ourselves, okay, we'll deal with it in 100 years from now, because who knows what could happen then. It doesn't make sense for us to take action when the whole population is dead already. Like, what was the point of learning about history, right? And then another way it affects us here in Canada is because a lot of our products, believe it or not, come from slave labor in East Turkestan. A CBC Marketplace report actually shows that tomatoes, something as simple as our groceries, for example, tomatoes, they've linked actually different major brands like Nestle, Del Monte, Unilever. They've traced back that these tomatoes have come from slave labor in East Turkestan. And even though a tomato sauce or tomato paste might say made in Italy, made in Tunisia, whatever country, it doesn't mean that the tomato came from that country. It just means that it was processed and then shipped here to Walmart, your Provigo, and so on and so forth. So again, so that's something that's not really spoken about, or it's very sneakily hidden under the rug. If we look at our face masks, for example, you know, something that's mandatory for us to wear. If you look at the back of your face mask box, you'll see different Chinese companies. Actually, according to New York Times, before the pandemic, there were only 4 PPE factories in all of East Turkestan. And now, after the pandemic in 2020, there are 51 different factories that propped up, and possibly even more, because this stat was in 2020. So, and they're being taken against their will to make these masks. And this isn't even talking about cotton, the cotton industry, and other products that we use here in Canada. So we should be very aware of where we're buying our things from.
I remember in 2021, when Canadian government started to make their voice heard on the world platform, when they said they will not be sending their athletes to Beijing Olympics, but now I am seeing that they have started going to Beijing. Why is that happening? Like, what's your view on it?
So what the Canadian government and many other governments have said is that they're doing a diplomatic boycott. So the athletes are still allowed to go, mm-hmm. but basically they will not be sending a diplomatic a representative to Beijing itself. But actually, this is very significant, because the Olympic Games isn't about the sports for the CCP. It's about showcasing the different infrastructure, the different development plans that they have in preparation for their Belt and Road Initiative, and to showcase the world that nothing's going on here. Like, we're just peaceful individuals, right? And it's part of the propaganda plan that they have. But it's very significant, actually, because by not sending an official, it is delegitimizing what they're doing and saying, hey, what the torture that you're doing to Uyghurs, the Tibetans, Taiwan, this is all, like, this isn't okay, and we will take a stand against this. And actually, I found this a little funny, actually, that the Chinese, this was an article on CBC, it says that China dismisses Canada and UK Olympic boycott as a farce. And it said the Chinese side expresses its strong dissatisfaction and firm opposition to this. So clearly they're very angry with this boycott. And in terms of the athlete, one can make the argument and say, well, you know, it's not their fault. They're just going to go compete and win their medal. But I mean, okay, let's take that at face value, but also think about it. Is it worth taking the chance to win an Olympic medal to be used as a free propaganda tool? And to also send out the message that nothing's happening here. And I feel like, as in addition to athletes, I feel like athletic therapists really play a big role in this as well. Because essentially, without athletic therapists, the athlete can't really function optimally, and you're going there to win a medal, right? So I believe if we all came together, if we all took a stance, I feel like that would be super powerful and would send a very, very big message to the CCP.
That's true. And today on Instagram platform, I was watching a video that was posted by you regarding how three person who have just won their medals, they are just celebrating on the tier, and people were showcasing that you should not be happy because they are using the Uyghurs for their own propaganda. So how do you feel to express your own views on such platforms, and have you ever heard something bad from people, or how it's been?
Well, it's been I don't want to say it's been an uphill battle, but it definitely shows, because I can see the analytics of my Instagram, and I noticed that, like, depending on what I post, it gets different amount of views. For example, like, I'm also very, well, I don't want to say very, but I am vocal about the Palestinian cause as well. And I'll notice it gets less views, and it all has to do with playing the algorithm. But so far, it's been pretty positive. People have been sharing the content, have been agreeing, and hopefully it has been educational as well. I haven't gotten any negative criticism so far, but, you know, I mean, I've only been at this for less than a year. So, I mean, you never know what could happen later down the road.
For sure. And after all of this is done, how do you see yourself in like 1-2 years? Will you be actively doing this, or you're just gonna use the Instagram platform to raise your voice, or you'll be seen in the different countries and stuff?
Well, personally, I don't really like posting too much about my life anyway. I never used to anyway. I only created an Instagram account to spread awareness. So ideally, I don't want to keep spreading awareness about this because I want this to end eventually, right? Because what do I gain out of this? This is something I do on my free time. This is something I've made a career out of, right? So ideally, hopefully, within the next few years, we see huge improvements to where East Turkestan is liberated and people can live their lives the way they want to. As for me, I mean, for now, that's all I have planned for myself. And yeah, so we'll see what the future holds with that.
Do you think it will stop?
Do I think it will stop? Yes. I think it's only a matter of time. Basically, what I think is, you know, especially coming at this from a religious point of view as well, but also a historical point of view, a lot of people are gravitated toward the story of the Pharaoh and of what he did to the children of Israel in Egypt. And there's a lot of parallels as well, because, for example, the Pharaoh saw himself as God, and Xi Jinping, the president of China, prime minister of China, leader of China, he's putting his own pictures in the mosque. So it's like they're praying to him, basically. So that's one parallel. Their forced abortion, that's another one, killing off the men. So, but I think a reason why people gravitate toward these stories, whether religious or not, is because there's still the archetype of Moses, who's always brought up in this. Whenever there's some sort of oppression, there's always someone to counteract that, whether it comes from within that place itself or outside. It's the same thing, David and Goliath. Like, it's that kind of story. So it's a recurring kind of archetypical story that people see. And that always remains constant. And the way I see it, and maybe we can kind of end with this, is maybe, like, hopefully, like, my goal for this podcast, for this radio interview right now, is to inspire at least one person to take action, because me and you, we're just two individuals, right? We can come up with all the ideas we want, sign all the petitions we want. But if it doesn't take a collective effort, nothing's really going to get done. So hopefully with this, we can inspire more people to take action, educate themselves, advocate in the right manner, and put an end to this reign of terror that the CCP has gone on with for far too long.
For sure. Again, it's not like we are trying to discourage somebody, or we're not trying to corner a community. It's more like we are trying to raise our voice against something that's deeply disheartening, mm-hmm. that is done by the CCP. People of China are really good. They are really helpful and friendly, but we are just raising our voice against a government that's not looking into every one of us. So that was the main goal behind this podcast, today's podcast. And I hope you guys learned something about it. We will cite all the references in today's episode and give it information on our website as well. So this is it for today.
But just real quick, I would just also like to one final little message. Now that the Olympics has started, which also coincides with the Gulja massacre as well, coincidentally. But now that the Olympics has started, I encourage everyone to not tune in to what's been dubbed the genocide games. And it really is the genocide games. Don't endorse it. Do not watch it at all costs. And stay away from it. We cannot continue to legitimize what the CCP is doing. And hopefully this does send a big message to CCP that what they're doing is wrong, and there are people that do care about what's happening in East Turkestan, that we will not stand for this.
Yeah. So that was the final message from Nabil, and we hope we can learn something from today's episode. And that's it. Thank you so much, Nabil, for coming and showcasing your voice and your opinions with all of us. It's been a pleasure interviewing you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. So this is it for today. And this is in the next episode, we're going to discuss about the life of international students with another person from Concordia University. So stay tuned for that. And this is it for today. And I hope to see you soon. Stay tuned at CGLO 1690 AM. Bye-bye.
desem edim ataya gül yala. Ayrılıp gideydisem o gül yala. Solga koptum yamana gül yala. Ayrılıp gideydisem o gül yala. Sen koygan durdum yamana. Sen kadrimni aklayala çikenge kıskan buncan men aklayala Gizekzige çikip aklayala peske karman yarim aklayala peske karman yarim aklayala bizni ot basit koyu Sana baka durmem.